Welcome to our podcast series on aging in developing countries. I'm Barbara Bowers, Emerita Professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Nursing. I'm here today with Assistant Professor Jing Wang from the University of New Hampshire School of Nursing, and she'll be talking to Dr. Patrick Wachholz. Dr. Wachholz is a geriatrician in Sao Paulo, Brazil. He's professor at the Botucatu Medical School at Sao Paulo State University. He's also a researcher at the Brazilian National Front for Strengthening Long-Term Care. This is a network that promotes and supports initiatives for long-term care and advocates for stronger public policies for older adults in long-term care. Dr. Wachholz also holds a PhD in public health. He served as director of the Department of Geriatric Medicine in a long-term care facility in Brazil, as a consultant to the Pan American Health Organization for the long-term care sector in Latin America, and is currently the executive editor of Geriatrics, Gerontology, and Aging. It's the scientific journal of the Brazilian Society of Geriatrics and Gerontology. He's particularly interested in national and international collaborations to develop and implement long-term care data systems. Now a bit about Brazil, a little background. Brazil is a middle-income developing country with a population of over 212 million. The latest information on aging in Brazil estimates that 13.7% of the population is now over 60. 60 is the age at which Brazilians are considered older adults, and it's actually the cutoff that many developing countries use to determine when people enter into old age. The current life expectancy for Brazilians is 76.4, up from 70 in the year 2000. The percentage of people over 60 in Brazil is projected to reach 25% by 2050. So Brazil is clearly a rapidly aging country. The fertility rate in Brazil has steadily declined from 6 in 1950 to the current 1.7. While free healthcare is considered a right for all Brazilians, they continue to experience access challenges. As a country with the largest landmass in the Americas and much of it dispersed rural populations, Brazil continues to struggle with achieving their universal access goal. Dr. Wachholz, welcome to our podcast series. Now I'll turn it over to Dr. Wang.
Thank you, Dr. Bowers. Hello, Patrick. Could you please give us an overview of long-term care in Brazil?
Yes. A couple weeks ago, the Pan American Health Organization asked me to develop a report exactly on how long-term care is structured in Latin American and Caribbean countries. So I started to retrieve information and reports. And Brazil is unfortunately a lot back when comparing to Chile, to Uruguay, to Costa Rica, for example. We don't have policies, national policies for long-term care. So most of care to dependent older people is really done inside the family's homes. Chile and Uruguay, for instance, they have governmental or financial support to hire personal assistants. They have financial support to start building or maintaining day centers for older people. And unfortunately, here in Brazil, we only have in a few cities day center. We don't have any kind of governmental and financial support for hiring personal assistants or hiring formal caregivers. So most of the care is really done by the families and mostly by women inside the families, as most Latin American and probably low middle income countries.
I think family plays an important caregiving role in countries around the world. As you just said, it's quite helpful to have support to hire assistance at home. What about residential long-term care? Is that developing in Brazil? And what does that look like?
We have long-term care facilities that are built for profit. They work in the, some of them akin to European or North American facilities. We only have a small number of specialized care homes for dementia, for people living with dementia, for instance. I guess we only have probably two in the country that are specialized, for example, really for people living with dementia. We have a high number of non-profit care homes. So they are what we call here as philanthropic homes. So they usually have financial support from municipalities to pay for their used for water, for cleaning material, but they usually don't have support for healthcare demands. Brazil has one of the biggest unified health system, so supposedly healthcare should be free for all citizens, but we know that people are living with dependency inside their homes and in long-term care facilities, they usually have difficulties reaching healthcare system. So usually they try to have some attention, usually primary care, but to have the physicians, the nurses going to the homes where people are living with dependency, not all cities have personnel to do visits in homes. And when another citizen is living in care homes, it's even more difficult to have health personnel going inside the homes to fill the health demands that these people need.
How about funding for both home and residential care? Is that mostly private pay?
Yes, for the for-profit homes, they are 100% based on families to pay for this kind of services. Within the non-profit homes, they usually have access when the public state prosecutors initiate a kind of legal action for vulnerable older person to get access to these facilities. So mostly when the public prosecutors identify with other government sectors, particularly for the social assistance, that an older people doesn't have family or doesn't have funding to live even in a non-profit home, the government issued a minimum for this person, but most of this money goes to the institution to pay for their needs. And usually a small proportion, less than 5 or 10% of these pensions or retirements and funding goes to the individual for their healthcare needs when they have sometimes to pay for a medication or to pay for a healthcare appointment with a physician. So mostly they have access when the public prosecutors or the other equipments dealing with social assistance help these people getting to their homes.
I assume it could be difficult to get a public prosecutor to take these cases. So what happens to people who don't have a public prosecutor working on their behalf?
Yeah, it's something really difficult to understand because currently we don't have a national database even to understand the number of care homes we have in Brazil. The last census on the sector was in 2010, and then at the time it was estimated on 2,500 facilities in Brazil. Only 30% of the cities in Brazil has had at least one facility. We are developing a research in Brazil from last August. Currently, we estimate the number of facilities in more than 7,000 in Brazil, but we are still looking for not registered facilities. They are difficult to access in some parts of the country, and the country is really huge. It's a continental country. But yes, we have a lot of vulnerable older people that did not have access to facilities because it's really difficult to have facility, particularly in small cities. So they sometimes live in chronic in hospitals that have people living for a long period of time. I'm not sure how it's called in other countries. We call it here. And it's something interesting is that according to national legislation, the long-term care facilities don't have to hire healthcare professionals. So they are mostly related to housing, to sheltering, particularly for the non-profit homes, sheltering vulnerable people. And obviously, these residents have healthcare needs. And so when they develop the healthcare needs, these small facilities or facilities in small cities, they try to get access using the national health system that is public is free, but it's really difficult to have all the medications these residents need, and sometimes even helping with nursing procedures. Small facilities sometimes can hire caregivers from caregivers, but usually we're losing the residents funding from this minimum fund.
Patrick, you made a distinction between registered and non-registered homes. How are they different?
Yes, for a home to be registered, they have to complete some requirements from the national legislation, including infrastructure, a minimum number of formal caregivers according to the level of dependency from the residents. So for, I guess it's one caregiver for, I'm not sure, but I think it's 10 older residents without any kind of difficulties in activities of daily living. When the residents have difficulties in cleaning, the number reduces to a caregiver for 8. And when they are total dependent, I guess it's one caregiver for each 4 or 6 residents. When a small facility particularly can't answer to all these requirements, they don't register. They only offer their services in a local community. They usually are for profit, but they are small. They don't have health professionals. They don't have sometimes funding for buying personal protective equipment and, for example, testing for COVID. But they probably find it easier to survive without having to apply for all the requirements that national legislation state.
So what's the advantage of being registered then?
Well, I guess being registered, they can offer their services, particularly for profit care homes. And the non-profit care homes, they can ask permission exactly to receive the pensions and retirement funding from the older residents living inside.
So what you have told us is that nursing homes provide mostly social care, that people in nursing homes still need to make their own arrangements to pay for medications and healthcare. Registered homes offer some healthcare depending on the dependency level of the residents. So who works in these homes and how are they trained?
Yes, for working as a formal caregiver, usually they have to participate in training, but we don't have legislation setting a formal caregiver as a profession, for instance. So there is no standard to train these caregivers. Usually the workforce depends highly on funding from each care homes. So when they have fundings, they can hire nurses or physicians. Most of the physicians are hired just to visit the residents, for example, once a week or twice a week. Most of them don't have doctors, but I'm not sure about the number. But when they have a nurse hired to facilities, usually it's because they have not only caregivers, but they have registered nurses. And when they don't, they are not registered nurses, what they are called. Yes, when facilities hire these not graduated nurses, they need to have registered nurses caring from this workforce. So it's more common to have nurses when they hire not only caregivers, but they hire not necessarily nonsense nurses.
So the workers you have just described are found in registered homes. Then who works in non-registered homes then?
Mainly caregivers that have they have training on regularly, usually from 6 months or less than 6 months. We don't have a standardized training for caregivers, but mostly care provided from hired caregivers in this small facilities.
And could you tell us where's the training done?
Well, some universities or some scientific societies like the Brazilian Geriatric Society, they offer this kind of training. There are some schools related to preparing younger people to enter the work markets, and we have these technique courses, is what they call that, usually have 6 months or no more than 1 year of training.
What about training for home care workers? Is it the same?
Not necessarily, because this training is not done, but do not have national standards. So in one region of the country, the training could be for a short period and with minimum requirements to understand how to help people with difficulties for daily activities. And sometimes the courses are longer for a year and with more practice. So it really depends on the region and what kind of society or institution is giving this training. Because when you want to work as a caregiver, particularly in Uruguay, you have to participate in a course that is certified by the government. Then they can be called personal assistant, and there is funding from the government to pay for this personal assistant at home. Usually they can't be related, they cannot be related to the family, so it's not for transfer money to the family. So if you want to work as a caregiver, you do the course and then you offer yourself to work, but not in your own family.
Thank you, Patrick. So is there any oversight, any regulatory agency that comes in and say you meet the standards or you don't meet the standards?
Yes, it's the health surveillance. When a facility wants to be registered, they have to send a requisition or to fill a form, and then the health surveillance go to this facility and says, okay, if you are not hiring someone to do the cleaning, to care for their meals, you have this kind of requirements if you are having your own personnel working for cleaning and for preparing the meals inside the homes, you have another kind of requirements. And for the caregivers, they usually try to understand if the residents have higher or lower degree of care dependency to understand how much caregivers are needed for each facility.
So, Patrick, is the process repeated or is it just one time when they apply to be registered?
Before the pandemic, they usually have the first visit. And when the facility doesn't fill all the requirements, they usually state a period when they are coming back to understand if the facility completed all the requirements or not. But after the pandemic, the public prosecutors get closest to the facilities, particularly those small facilities, because we had, I'm not sure how much, but a lot of facilities closing after the pandemic because they can't pay for their bills, they can't buy PPEs, they can't hire more caregivers because when their caregivers are ill, it's difficult to hire new workforce. So a lot of small facilities closed, and then the residents didn't have another facility to enter. After that, the public prosecutors start getting more in touch with these facilities to help them to assure most of them receive the funding that the federal government delivered, I guess, last May. That's now May 2020, but it stopped, I guess, in last January. But it's only when they have more close and repeated visits to the facilities. It's something that it's regional. In states like São Paulo or Rio de Janeiro, the health surveillance teams are bigger, and then they can go to make inspections twice a year at least. But in the Northeast region, usually they have visits, I don't know, once each 3 years, 5 years, or sometimes never.
What about the specialized health workers? Nurses, doctors who are caring for patients in nursing homes or in their own homes. Are there many healthcare providers trained in geriatrics?
No, I guess 2018, there was a census to understand how much geriatricians we have in the country, and we have a huge deficit on the number of geriatricians in the country. Gerontological training is something that's not standardized in the country. The Brazilian Society of Geriatrics and Gerontology have annually certificating process for health professionals that want to have gerontological training recognized, but the profession societies, some usually they don't offer any kind of visibility or help in training this kind of gerontological needs. So particular for understanding what is person-centered care, I guess we are still in its infancy. We don't have this concept understand and discuss it, both in academy and particularly in the long-term care sector.
So what care do you think that most families would expect for their older family members?
Yes, I guess most of the family would want to gain access to medication, to help in caring for the older adult, and probably they try to reach this kind of expectations, probably not related to improving the quality of care.
So if you went into a care home, can you think of one or two things that you would observe that would tell you this is probably good, it's probably providing quality care?
Yeah. Well, I would try to observe how the workforce try to understand and to build relationships to engage with the residents so they can easily understand their needs, their options, their demands when they are on a difficulty or a crisis, or when it's a time to understand if they need end-of-life care. So I would try to observe how the workforce build relationships with the residents. I guess how the care is individualized, the activities for the residents. They are not only treated as sheep in a large building, if they have meaningful activities.
What happens to someone living in a care home who becomes much more dependent than when they first arrived?
In some small facilities, if you get access to these facilities, having full ability to deal, to cope with the activities of daily living, and then you get or decreases your ability. Some facilities have contacts with the family that if this happens, they have to go to another kind of facilities, usually non-profit facilities that receive these residents through the public prosecutors. They don't have this option. So they have to hire nurses and to increase their workforce, but they don't have the option of transferring this resident to another facility.
Do you use many volunteers in nursing homes or hospitals to help take some of the burden off the staff?
In care homes and in hospitals, there are a lot of volunteers that during the pandemic, probably from March 2020 to last June, they were not allowed to enter the care homes. And this burdened even more the workforce. But outside the pandemic context, yes, we are. Particularly in bigger cities, where there are a lot of groups that offer help for people living in care homes and in chronic units. For care inside homes, I don't think so. It's really difficult.
So what would you like to say to any researchers who might be listening to this podcast? What are some issues you might like to collaborate on with researchers around the world?
Yes, for us, it's really important to understand how we can build national data sets. We find it very important to build long-term care policies to understand how the sector is available in the country, how long-term care can be funded. It's something that it's really will be probably the most challenge, I guess, for society and for families. I guess how we can build a long-term care sector and different services, housing, residential services, home care centers, and how we can not only build but fund this kind of options. Because I think we have difficulties even in Latin American and Caribbean countries understand how care dependency is evaluated to national service. So you don't have a pattern to ask the questions to understand what is the number of people living with difficulties on activities of daily living. So usually the questions are drawn by the government needs. So if you want less people in the long-term needs of financial and funding, you have different questions. And I think this is something that we have to develop cross-national research to understand how we can maximize the inclusion of people living with disabilities and difficulties, in particular in families, but also in the need of long-term care.
Is this issue of any interest to the policymakers?
A movement from researchers, from long-term care managers, from non-governmental institutions start exactly to create a movement to inform legislators on the needs of long-term care. We observe that a lot of small facilities closed, and then we start to create a movement to understand how the sector is structured in Brazil, and how we can start to build research priorities and an agenda to construct long-term care policies. So now we have at least monthly meetings with national chambers, with researchers, with academia, and with managers of long-term care facilities and public prosecutors to let them understand what difficulties they are facing and how we can build national policies for the long-term care sector.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wacholtz and Dr. Wang. Something I found particularly interesting is the focus you talked about on shelter and safe accommodation, with much less emphasis, I noticed, on medical issues of residents. I think you're at an interesting developmental crossroads here. Many in developing countries are struggling with this balance between medical issues and quality of life or support, social, what many refer to as social care. They're certainly both important, but sometimes really at odds. Some, like, particularly in the West, in developed countries, would suggest that we've gone a little too far in the direction of a medical care focus with insufficient attention to quality of life. It's certainly a focus of discussion in the U.S. and in many Western countries. This is a place, I think, where collaboration between researchers and practitioners in the U.S. and Brazil could be really useful and could have, I think, global implications. Another issue you raised, which I found interesting, is the need for more specialized training in geriatrics. We know that high-quality care for older adults requires this very particular expertise, and not all older adults across the world, not just in Brazil, have access to geriatric care specialists. I know this is something you are particularly working on, Dr. Wacholtz, and a lot of the training that you've been involved in. It's an issue worldwide, so thank you for that. Another area for us to collaborate on. Thanks so much for a great discussion, and thank you, Dr. Wang.
The Gerontological Society of America was founded in 1945 to cultivate excellence in interdisciplinary aging research and education to advance innovations in practice and policy. For more information about GSA, visit geron.org, G-E-R-O-N.org.